This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm Jennifer Byrne, and by whatever technology you're receiving me, whether it's under the mighty cosmic umbrella of the World Wide Web or courtesy the humble grooved dial of your radio, I am very glad you can, because we have some interesting guests along tonight. I think you'll enjoy meeting them. From Berlin, for instance, last night we had Serbia, tonight Berlin. And from there, we'll be talking to the author of a book with the enticing title, The Seduction of Culture in German History. A prize winner it is. In fact, author Wolf Lepenies will be receiving his award next month at the famous Frankfurt Book Fair. He's won this year's Peace Prize from the German book trade. But tonight, he'll be telling us about the apparent paradox of Germany's nature. That a country so passionately attached, even obsessed, Lepenies says, with the values of high culture can display such moral failure, such slavish attachment to authority during the years of the Third Reich. Hitler's devotion to Wagner, the grand architectural fantasies of Albert Speer, it all fits. It's all part of the seduction. And we'll be hearing more about that a little later in the program. Also, the unfolding nightmare that is Darfur in Western Sudan, a catastrophe in the making, is how the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan described it a bit earlier today. Others, of course, have compared it to Rwanda and say that what's happening there is in fact the first genocide of the 21st century. The crunch is coming at the end of this month when the small contingent of African peacekeepers who have been there since May, servicing a very ropey peace treaty. Anyway, they're due to withdraw from Darfur, leaving, well, what? That's what we'll be talking about shortly. But first up, I am joined by LNL's regular Canberra correspondent, Christian Kerr, a man, I believe, of precisely the sort of sound, strong, free and fair Australian values that opposition leader Kim Beazley thinks we should all be manifesting. Is that true, Christian?
Oh, absolutely. Dinky day, yes. I even have an Akubra somewhere in the wardrobe.
I should hope so. Well, before we move on to more serious matters, who is this washing down in Canberra? This idea that visitors, even just casual visa visitors, should be signing on to Australian values?
Look, earlier today there were ministerial staffers who were saying that the Labor Party was actually making quite an impact on its policy attack on the government. Suddenly everything's gone very wrong because of such a shameless populist stunt. Somebody commented today that Australia values its laws and that it also values its Alan Jones, and that's the sort of pitch that Beazley was doing. It's just such shock jockery. It's such populism, and it really shows such a blatant desire to win that it's probably actually made the opposition leader look weaker.
I mean, is it popular or is it just silly?
I think it's just silly. He got a caning from his party when they met this morning. A number of members and senators spoke pretty strongly against it. Probably the loudest and certainly one of the most influential was Robert Ray. He very much gave Beazley some healthy advice by asking, are you going to dump it this week or dump it next? That's a pretty clear hint. But it looks as if Beazley's prepared just to push on with it and probably hope that something else picks up the airtime and starts dominating the media agenda.
It reminds me of those forms you have to sign when you go to America, and they don't ask sort of subtle questions. It's like, have you now or will you ever in the near future smuggle drugs? Are you a killer? You know, that's sort of it. And you tick no, and they don't seem to worry about it too much.
Look, there was absolutely no subtlety about this at all. You've also got to wonder, though, if there was any thought in it. When the debrief happened after the opposition party room meeting, I mean, even that was fairly heated and got thrown up to the party room spokesperson. I mean, did anyone in the party ask, what happens if you actually say no to this form? Watch them if you say, no, I don't agree with Australian values. They didn't have an answer. Obviously, this sort of thing just has not been considered. It's just a very naked populist gesture. And as I said, it's probably weakened Beazley by undermining his policy credibility at the time when he was finally picking some up.
On the government side, it's out with the sale of Medibank, at least temporarily, and in with the debate over media ownership.
Yeah, the Medibank issue is just an interesting one to think of in passing, because the idea was to have the sale completed before next year's election. It just means that a privatisation is still going to be hanging around. It's just, you'd think, a bit of a lightning rod for some populist anger and maybe something you don't want in an election year. But yes, we're finally seeing probably the last big major policy change of this government. Or at least this term in government, and that's the final introduction of the government's media legislation, something that the government's been keen to do in all the 10 years it's been in office and never really had the numbers to do until now. And, of course, this is going to shape up as the next big Senate test.
Will they have the numbers? But, of course, in the Senate, will they have the support that they need?
Well, this is the really interesting detail here. The media changes are replacing the cross-media ownership restrictions with minimum levels of diversity of voices. That's the terminology the government's using. They're talking about a minimum of 5 voices in metropolitan areas and 4 in regional areas. Now, according to some calculations, say in major capital cities like Sydney or Melbourne, you've got above 11 voices at moment, or 11 voices at the moment. So actually, it could represent a significant loss of diversity in media. And it's in the regional areas, though, where this seems to be a particular concern. Now, it's been running all day that 2 National Party members reserved their right to oppose the legislation when it was discussed in the government party room meeting. Now, it just depends who you actually talk to about the people who attended that meeting, because a number of names are being thrown around. I mean, there are the obvious suspects like Barnaby Joyce and the New South Wales National Senator Fiona Nash. Both of them, if they chose not to support the legislation in the Senate, could create some real problems for the government. But there are also a number of names of members of the House of Representatives who are being tipped to oppose this bill. People like Paul Neville, who's had a strong record of scuttling some of the previous attempts to change media ownership. Deanne Kelly. We've even had people like John Forrest, the former National Party whip, who, when he voted against the refugee bills recently, scuttled his career as whip. So we are getting other names appearing. There's still a couple more out there. There could be opposition in both houses. And, of course, if you get that significant opposition in the Senate, it just means the legislation can't proceed.
And on the precedent of what happened with the legislation regarding refugees being processed abroad, and, of course, John Howard stepping back from that, is this one he's going to die in a ditch over? Because, all the word is no, not really. He's not necessarily going to push this one to the maximum.
No, I mean, there have been a few different versions of the package drifting around. I mean, at some stage earlier this year, it looked as if the government would almost go for complete deregulation. I mean, we're living in an era where the boundaries of media are just blurring so rapidly. I mean, just the way people are going to be listening to this program, the traditional very clear delineations between print and electronic media are just blurring so much with everything being delivered online. This package the government said was to update laws to take account for technology. Really, the best way of taking account of new technology is just to throw out the law book and really just let those services exist and operate in a free market. It is so much that you can't, the way Australia took so long to get colour television and FM radio, I mean, those sorts of technologies which require the sort of complicated hardware are no longer the new technologies we talk about. It's just very much what's delivered online. And it's just like so much, you can watch American television programs, you can watch television programs from virtually anywhere, delivered over the internet. You can have radio streamed from virtually anywhere. And, of course, we're already reading newspapers from around the world online. So, in a way, this isn't... It doesn't have that sort of same attachment for the government and for John Howard as it may have had in the past. It was work that's there to be done, part of the agenda, but it's probably not going to be a die-in-the-ditch issue.
Mm. Just a last very quick one, which is the chief scientist, Dr. John Peacock, gave a briefing, as I understand, to government MPs today. What about that? I mean, that could be another cause of dissent, couldn't it?
Well, the briefing's down for tomorrow, and this is an interesting one. It's Mal Washer and Jeannie Ferris, two government backbenchers, who have got the chief scientist, Jim Peacock, in. They've also got a couple of other big names, Ian Fraser, the immunologist, who was Australian of the Year this year. The stem cell legislation isn't yet in the chamber. It's going to be a private member's bill. There are two rival ones, one from the former Health Minister, Kay Patterson, and one from Natasha Stott-Despoja. Probably the government one will get up. And, of course, once you have conscience votes and people can actually freely exercise their mind, you start getting people wondering if they might actually be able to freely exercise their minds on other issues. So having the two together could be interesting.
Indeed. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Thanks so much, Christian Kerr there, not just LNL's political correspondent, of course, in Canberra, but also representing Crikey.com. Time now to look at the unfolding calamity of Darfur, and more specifically, at what, if anything, the world should be doing about that calamity, because things do now seem to be moving towards a critical pass. I say that, of course, against a background with which many LNL listeners will already be familiar, that dreadful drumbeat of statistics that's been coming out of Darfur for the last 3 years, around 300,000 killed, 2 million displaced, up to 3 million dependent on humanitarian aid. Terrible figures. But it was Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, who, as I mentioned a little earlier, said today that the situation in Darfur had reached a critical moment. The Security Council has authorised a peacekeeping mission to Darfur, but, of course, Sudan's president is refusing to let the UN into the country. He says not only that he can stop the genocide that's occurring there himself, but if the UN enters Sudan, he will fight them personally, and the Sudanese army will take on international soldiers, quote, as Hezbollah beat Israeli forces. So what does the UN do next? Is it now the time to intervene? And if so, what is the situation that the international peacekeepers would be walking into? My two guests coming up have both got very, very strong opinions on this issue. First, Samantha Power. She is a professor of human rights practice at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide. And she spent the last year working as a foreign policy advisor to Democrat Senator Barack Obama. Samantha joins us from Massachusetts. And Alan Cooperman is from the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, the author of The Limits of Humanitarian Intervention, which looks specifically at the case of Rwanda, he's on the phone from Austin, Texas. Welcome both of you to Late Night Live. Samantha, if I could start with you. You have been an advocate for some years for international intervention in Darfur. Now, that UN Security Council meeting, which has recently been held, do you believe it's achieved anything? Is there movement towards that goal?
No, there's no movement at all. I spoke yesterday with people on the staff of Secretary General Kofi Annan, and really what you have, it has followed a pattern, but about every month or two, the states that comprise the Security Council come together. They denounce the horrors in Darfur. They pat themselves on the back for being seized of the matter, and then they pretty much go about their business. I mean, ultimately, in order to get the consent that you would need in order to deploy a UN peacekeeping force, because if you don't have consent, it's not a peacekeeping force, it's a war-making force, which is not something that anybody has an appetite for at present in the wake of Iraq. But what you need, of course, is to peel away Sudan's many, many allies on the international stage, you know, everything from China to the countries that comprise the Arab League to, in fact, some of its allies even within the African Union, which is very, very split on whether the AU should hand over to a UN force. And those allies are not being solicited behind the scenes to the degree that they are. They're not coming around. So none of the diplomatic legwork is done in advance of these Security Council meetings. And even if it were, there's no guarantee that some of these countries wouldn't continue to close ranks behind the Sudanese.
But in the meantime, I mean, government troops are going in, there's aerial bombing. Violence, as I understand it, has escalated to the worst it's been since 2004.
Yes, I mean, while the parents are away, the children will play. It is, they're in basically since the attacks began or the war began in southern Lebanon and all attention that was directed toward Sudan dried up. There wasn't all that much at that point anyway. But there has been a massive degeneration in the violence there and in the climate. Yeah, 200 women were raped at one camp alone in South Darfur about a month ago. 9 humanitarian aid workers were killed in a single month this summer. So, you know, just being an aid worker doesn't even buy you impunity. And as you mentioned, there is this now this massing of troops. And what people may not be all that aware of is the Darfur Peace Agreement, which was signed back in early May with the participation of one of the rebel groups, the main rebel group. But it authorizes the Sudanese government to do the disarming of the Janjaweed, who are the Arab militia who've gone into Darfur, some of whom lived there before. And so the Sudanese are now saying, look, we were authorized by this U.S.-sponsored deal to go and do this disarmament. That's what we're going to go do. We're going to disarm anybody who's not supportive of this deal. They actually refer to people who don't support the deal as terrorists, and they've said that they've gone to Darfur now to destroy them, which, you know, from their perspective, they say, well, look, it was in the deal. The problem is virtually all civilians living in the camps in Darfur do not support the Darfur Peace Agreement, not because they don't want peace, but because there are no enforcement provisions that they respect that are in the deal. So there's a chance that they could, in fact, destroy the civilians, viewing them or writing them all off as terrorists. And that's what we're on the brink of right now. And the African Union force that is there just doesn't have either the numbers, the hardware, the mandate, the reach, the movement to be able to offer much in the way of meaningful protection. That said, they're probably better than no force at all.
But they're not even meant to be there for much longer, aren't they? Meant to be moving out at the end of the month?
Maybe the only good news is that it looks, there's been no formal decision on this, but just from talking to people at the AU, it does look like they are going to muddle along. I don't know if that's good news, but it may be better than the alternative, which is just leaving the Sudanese, you know, free reign within Darfur. So there are just signs, you know, they haven't, they've renewed troop rotations, which they had halted. Again, there's been no decision. There won't be any decision until September 30th. But the signs are good that force will turn over and muddle along at least until the end of the year. And maybe in the meantime, somebody can actually start doing some diplomacy and trying to isolate Sudan so that it feels like it has no choice but to allow, if not a UN force, we can call it something else, because there's going to be a lot of face that will need to be saved by Sudan if this is to happen. But the most important thing is, you know, a force that can actually offer civilians some meaningful protection, but one that also has the consent of the government, because, again, there is no appetite to make war, even to stop genocide.
Well, Alan, I'd like to bring you in here. You have been a reluctant conscript to the argument for an international force, haven't you?
Well, my goal is to save lives, and my argument has been that at this point, international military intervention would be counterproductive.
The case being?
Well, the case being severalfold. First of all, as Samantha articulately put forward, at this point, if we were to intervene militarily, it would be against the will of the Sudanese government, and that would be going to war. And it's not clear that would help matters to go to war against the Sudanese government. Were we to do so, the folks who would suffer would be the civilians in between. The other point, which seems to be lost a lot of the time in the debate, is that the Sudanese government has signed a peace agreement in this case, just as it did in the North-South Civil War. And in the North-South Civil War, both sides signed the peace agreement, and the Sudanese government permitted UN peacekeepers in. The difference in Darfur is not that the Sudanese government hasn't signed the peace agreement, but the rebels haven't signed the peace agreement. And yet all of the rhetoric internationally is that we have to pressure the Sudanese government. My argument is they've signed the peace agreement. It's not them that we have to pressure. It's the rebels whom we have to pressure. We have to get them on board the peace agreement. And once we do that, then it would be appropriate to send in UN peacekeepers. And my guess is that the Sudanese government would permit UN peacekeepers once the rebels have signed the peace agreement.
You seem to express a degree of confidence in the Sudanese government, but isn't this the same government which is widely accused of having recruited this Janjaweed militia, and basically they're the ones organizing the aerial bombing now?
Yeah, I mean, no one can defend the tactics of the Sudanese government, either in the earlier North-South Civil War or in the more recent civil war in Darfur. On the other hand, we shouldn't simply vilify them, because if you look at their actions over the last few years, you actually see significant signs of progress. You see them kicking out the most radical Islamist member of the party. You see them cooperating on anti-terrorism. You see them signing a North-South peace agreement. You see them permitting UN peacekeepers into the South. You see them, after international pressure, you see them reining in the Janjaweed in Darfur. You see them permitting in African Union monitors into Darfur. You see them signing a peace agreement in Darfur. So it's not as if they always are doing the wrong thing. They've actually done the right thing many times along the way.
Okay.
And so it's not that I'm no supporter. I have no relationship with the Sudanese government, but we shouldn't ignore the fact that they've actually been cooperating more than the other side.
Samantha, I imagine you have a response to that.
Well, there is a small little footnote of the 300,000 dead people, but we'll leave that off the list of things that the Sudanese government are responsible for, because as Alan says, that's something that you began your program with, and it is often mentioned. But the notion that the Sudanese have disarmed or even begun disarming the Janjaweed is defied by every report that the African Union has written, or the reports of reporters, the few reporters who've actually managed to get into Darfur. The only way you can get in is, in fact, to sneak in these days, because the Sudanese government is so aware of what it is doing that it denies journalists sort of legal access. To Alan's more important point, I think, about the Darfur peace agreement, he's absolutely right that the Sudanese signed it. They did sign it. Again, just as we've had, you know, there are many parties to many agreements in recent years. I know that Alan has studied, that I have studied, who sign agreements, who recognize that it's a good idea to just sign whatever's in front of you if you know that it has no teeth, and if you know that you, in fact, are in charge of implementing it and don't need to rely on anybody on the outside. He's right that there are two or three rebel parties, that number actually increases every day, who did not sign. These rebel groups sort of splinter off and proliferate at a rate that is truly unfortunate. The shape of the negotiating table goes from having to be a square, you know, to being a pentagon and a hexagon, and you know, it's just devastating to a peace process in its own right, the degree to which these rebel movements are divided among themselves, and the degree to which they are becoming, indeed, the spoilers when it comes to attacking humanitarian aid groups, when it comes to even attacking civilians. So he's absolutely right that we have to sit on the rebels, but sitting on the rebels and not dealing with the structural problem that the Sudanese initiated this very, very brutal response to an insurrection in Darfur. And, you know, pressure has to be brought to bear on both. The rebels don't have the number of allies that the Sudanese government have to turn to. And I think Alan is very, very mistaken if he believes that the Sudanese are just going to walk back from their anti-colonial, anti-imperial rhetoric with regard to the UN force. He's right that they did that with regard to the North-South deal, but they had not gone nearly as far down the rhetorical garden path as they have in this instance.
I'd like to ask both of you, actually. Basically, President Omar al-Bashir has said that the Sudanese government forces can ultimately take over from the African Union troops, but whatever, they're saying they can stop the genocide without international intervention. Can I have a response from you first, Samantha?
Well, they could stop the genocide. They're doing it so they can stop it. The problem with the focus on you know, sort of simply the Sudanese government and simply the rebels is that there's the, again, minor detail of 3 million people who may or may, you know, only a fraction of whom have actually taken up arms, who themselves do not trust the Sudanese government because they remember Sudanese planes coming into their villages, strafing the villages, or Sudanese soldiers in cahoots with the, you know, non-uniformed Arab militia, and winning the trust of those people, you know, getting them to place their destinies in the hands of the very people who have cleansed them in the first place is just not a task that is viable. And that's the whole idea of having an international protection force, and again, I don't think anybody's talking about international military intervention of a non-consensual kind, is that they have some security, some sort of walk-back escorts, you know, to their villages, and they get, you know, one gets a chance for peace to exist for a little while long before, you know, one can imagine coexistence, never mind reconciliation. That's what a protection force is for, and that's why the Sudanese can't do it.
I want to come back to you in a minute on the protection force, but just quickly, for you, Alan, do you believe that Bashir is actually to be trusted on this and can ultimately prevent, you know, scale down the violence?
Well, I think the proof of the pudding will be in the eating, but I think what he will do will depend in part on what the international community does. I think there's two things we could do that won't work. One would be sort of to wash our hands of this place and ignore it. If we do that, then I think Samantha's right that he would continue to arm and support the Janjaweed and there would be atrocities. The other thing I think would not work is if we put lots of pressure, such as sanctions, and say, the fault of this is all the Sudanese government. Sudanese government has to get out of Darfur and so forth. I think at that point he would get his back up and he would just do whatever the heck he wanted in Darfur. So I think what we really need to do is to put appropriate diplomatic pressure on and say, look, if these rebels have refused to sign a peace agreement, you actually have a right to fight them. Right? No government should be forced to unilaterally surrender to rebels. You have a right to fight them, but the question is, how do you fight them? If you fight them in a disciplined way with regular forces, not with Janjaweed militia, but with regular forces, if you permit humanitarian aid to civilians while you're fighting the war, that's okay. That we will tolerate. What we will not tolerate is you arming Janjaweed militias. We will not permit you denying humanitarian aid. And if you continue to do that, then we will punish you.
Okay, can I just hold you?
So to set up a carrot and a stick for the Sudanese government.
I'm just going to hold you there 1 second. We'll be coming back to you, Alan, just that Samantha has to go shortly, and I'd just like to get a final response from you, Samantha, before you leave.
Well, I just, you know, think it's unrealistic to rely on the Sudanese, but
when, this, you know, international protection force that you're advocating, what, just before you go,
please,
explain what composition it would have. You're saying that clearly it can't be imposed. Where are these soldiers? Where is this protection force going to come from?
Well, that is a really, really important question. I mean, the irony of the current debate that we're having, which is all around Sudanese consent and all around getting them to relent, to acquiesce, you know, to allow the United Nations to take over from the African Union with a better mandate, with troops, with, you know, more mobility and potentially bigger guns so that the civilians feel safer and potentially they can fight back. But, you know, it has to be said, Alan's right, fight back against the rebels who are harassing aid workers, give escorts to humanitarian aid convoys that have been blocked. You know, only 50% of those who are receiving humanitarian assistance just 3 months ago are getting it today. So that's the notion of what the force would be, probably in the realm of 20,000 to 25,000. But the thorny issue.
But from where?
Well, this is the point. I mean, you know, before, when it looked like, in the wake of signing the agreement, the Sudanese looked like they were going to allow a UN force, the big debate then was, where on earth are these troops going to come from? We've just seen in Lebanon with UNIFIL and the effort to bolster the force in southern Lebanon that these are not the kinds of tasks that countries really like performing. They don't like putting their troops in harm's way for their own national interests, never mind for the national interests or the civilian interests of others in other countries. And it is truly a begging bowl task that has been underway behind the scenes in New York as the head of peacekeeping goes country by country, ambassador by ambassador, and like Oliver Twist, you know, just said, can I have some more, please? You know, could I have a few police? Could I have a couple hundred soldiers? The Swedish ambassador to the UN I spoke with last week, and he was thrilled because he'd just gotten his prime minister to commit 200 troops. well, 200 Swedes, you know, to the UN force. It's going to take a lot more of those kinds of commitments.
And, you know, yeah, they certainly.
So it's, there is a void internationally when it comes to peacekeeping. And one of the other dirty secrets is that Western governments have gotten out of the peacekeeping business almost altogether. So there's a sort of apartheid in peacekeeping where rich countries pay for it, and it's actually left to very poor countries in the developing world to implement it, and often they don't actually have the skills or the equipment to do the job right. So it's we have many more messes down the line, but we'd be lucky to get there. The first thing is to get the diplomacy right and get the Sudanese to agree to a force.
I mean, you've written about that colossal void, but the point is that, you know, some people, I think the NATO head was one of them, pointing out that Africans do feel strongly they should be responsible for events on their own continent, and they want to deal with it themselves.
Well, and they should be applauded for going in there when the place was on fire, and, you know, they've done, certainly a passable job and have taken an increasingly large number of casualties in doing it. But even the African Union has come together and said, after much reluctance initially, we want to hand over to the UN. Maybe we'll be absorbed by the UN force, because the Africans, in all likelihood, will constitute the backbone of this new force. But we need help. We need more logistic support. We need more equipment, and we need more people who can go to the greater reaches of Darfur.
Okay. Listen, I'll let you go, because I know you've got a very important phone call. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you. Really appreciate your company, Samantha Power. Alan, please stay with us, because I want to press you on this International Protection Force, because you have been far less enthusiastic, and even Samantha is saying she can't actually say who it should be or how many. Does it mean anything? Is it just one of those sort of wish lists that wouldn't it be good to have someone to go in there and save us?
Well, again, it depends whether or not there's the consent of the Sudanese government. If there's not the consent of the Sudanese government, then,
well, there's not, is there? So, excuse me,
well, interrupting. At the moment, there's not. And so, number one, no one is going to volunteer to go in there, because it's going to war against Sudan. And number two, no one should, because it would be a bad idea. It would be counterproductive for the very civilians whom we're trying to protect. But my point is that if we can put pressure on the rebels so that they say we have a choice between defeat or signing the peace agreement, then we might get the Darfur rebels to sign the peace agreement, as we did one faction. In fact, the main faction has signed the peace agreement, and the government of Sudan now treats them as an ally. So if we can get the other rebels on board the peace agreement, then the Sudanese government, I believe, and Samantha's skeptical of this, but I believe that if the rebels signed the peace agreement, then the Sudanese government would be willing to allow UN peacekeepers. And the reason I believe that is because that's what Sudan did in the south when they signed the North-South peace agreement. They've allowed 10,000 UN peacekeepers there. They wouldn't consider it a violation of sovereignty, because there's no longer an ongoing war in the south. So if the war would stop in Darfur, then Sudan wouldn't consider a peacekeeping force to be a violation of sovereignty. They wouldn't fear that the peacekeepers were going to help the rebels, because the rebels already would have agreed to peace.
But, Alan, do you ever feel discomforted at all by your perception of the situation? Basically, you're saying, you know, the rebels have got to be shown discipline, shown responsibility, and that you do have faith in the Sudanese government. Compared to, as you've written in the New York Times, the thousands of Americans who wear green wristbands and totally believe that some kind of military intervention, if not peacekeeping intervention, is absolutely vital. I mean, there's a very big gap there, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the great thing about the Save Darfur movement and organizations that support doing something in Darfur, and the folks who are wearing green wristbands, and the folks who sacrifice of their own time to try and raise consciousness about that, the great thing is that people care about each other in the world, and that they're trying to actuate this concept of never again, so that it's not just never again the Holocaust in Europe against Jews, but never again genocide against anyone. And that sort of consciousness raising is wonderful. The downside is that any sort of bumper sticker movement is going to be oversimplified. And in this case, it's oversimplified because it puts all of the blame on the Sudanese government and none of the blame where at this point it really belongs, which is with rebels who could end the genocide rather quickly by simply signing a peace agreement.
So in short, you don't accept the comparison that is often made to Rwanda.
It's a very different situation. I wrote a book on Rwanda, and I've been following the Darfur situation daily for years. And the fact of the matter is that in Rwanda, one side decided that they wanted to exterminate the other side. And they put a full bore effort into doing so. And that simply has not happened in Darfur.
Had
the government wanted to do that, it would have done that. Instead, what you have in Darfur is you have a very brutal civil war where the government has, one could argue criminally, decided to fight this war on the cheap by arming a local militia, which has committed some atrocities and some abuses, and in fact a large number of abuses in fighting the war. But it has not been a war of attempted extermination. It simply has not.
So the use, despite the use of the word genocide by many, including, I think, wasn't it former Secretary of State Colin Powell?
Yeah, I mean, it does... I've used the word genocide in Darfur. A large number of people have been destroyed in the course of fighting this war. But that's not certainly what is going on currently. And it's not as if the Sudanese government itself has been doing that. It's not as if the Sudanese army has been doing that. The Sudanese army has been fighting a war. The Sudanese government has been fighting a war against rebels. And the Sudanese government has signed a peace agreement. It said not only do we agree not to commit genocide, we agree to stop fighting the war if the other side will simply agree to the peace agreement.
Well,
and the rebel faction that has done so has been rewarded for signing the peace agreement. In fact, the leader of that rebel faction is now in the Sudanese government. The fourth highest-ranking member of the Sudanese government is a rebel who signed the agreement just in May. So the Sudanese government has said, we're willing to accept peace. And it's really, at this point, the rebels who are unwilling to accept peace. And they may have legitimate grievances. And they may, in fact, not think this peace agreement is ideal. But if I were a rebel leader and I had a choice between a non-ideal peace agreement or continuing genocide against my people, I would sign the peace agreement.
Mm-hmm. Alan Cooperman, thank you very much for joining us tonight on Late Night Live. Been great to hear from you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan Cooperman there. He's speaking to us from Austin, Texas, from the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. And, of course, before we had Samantha Power, Professor of Human Rights Practice at Harvard and Pulitzer Prize-winning author. She had, I believe, a phone call from Kofi Annan, which is why we were so agreeable to letting her go early. We felt it probably, the claim, important as we are, the claim was just that smidge higher, which is why we let her go. You're with Late Night Live. Okay, you're with Late Night Live, as I say, on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia via the web and on your MP3 player. Now, during the Allied bombing of German cities like Dresden, Hitler was more concerned by the loss of cultural treasures than he was by human casualties. This strange reversal of priorities might be taken as a further mark, if one were needed, of the dictator's inhumanity. But at the time, his propagandists broadcast the fact. They actually broadcast it because they believed it would impress the German public because it revealed Hitler's cultural sensitivity, the artist's spirit inside the military uniform. Well, our next guest on LNL, Wolf Lepenies, has explored the tradition out of which such thinking emerged, the German tendency to value cultural achievement above all else, and most importantly, to see culture as a noble substitute for politics. Wolf is one of Germany's foremost intellectuals. He served as rector and is now permanent fellow of the German Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin. He's also a professor of sociology at the Free University in Berlin and has spent a number of years at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. He's recently been named the winner of the 2006 Peace Prize of the German Book Trade, a highly prestigious award whose former winners include Orhan Pamuk, Susan Sontag and Vaclav Havel. And now, of course, we have Wolf Lepenies. Good evening to you.
Good evening.
Now, look, your new book, as I mentioned, is titled The Seduction of Culture in German History. And while I'm tempted to jump straight in on this fascinating observation on Hitler, I'll pull myself back and ask about the historical origins of that seduction, because you see it dating right back to the late 18th century, I believe.
Yes, I think one have to retrace it as far back as actually others have done. I'm not the first to do that. It has something to do with the fact that Germany becomes a nation so late. Actually, we have been called the belated nation, the verspätete Nation. And giving these priorities to culture is a sort of compensation, is a sort of consolation for coming politically so late.
Right. And we explained that this origin of Germanic high culture, you know, with capital letters, capital HC.
Well, as I said, it has something to do with the fact that the German middle classes and the cultural elite, way into the 20th, one would almost say, century, are rather kept out of power and are not part of the political game, as it were, and therefore have to find a compensation in other spheres, and this sphere has been culture. And at the same time, Germany develops into a nation that thinks that it is distinguished by its culture from other countries, notably the Western democracies, which are only, in quotation marks, civilizations.
So what were they seen as? When Germans thought culture, what did they see as opposed to politics?
Well, I guess it's the same as today, actually, though the problem of overestimating culture at the expense of politics, I would argue, no longer exists, at least not in the dramatic form it did until the end of the Second World War. Well, when we think about culture, we have a rather narrow view of it. For us, it is literature, it's painting, it's music. It's not so much the kind of broad notion of culture, the anthropological notion, which you have in the Anglo-Saxon countries, though we have learned to use that as well. But for us, it is high culture, and normally it is then written with a capital K or C when others quote us.
And what does that mean to a German, high culture?
Well, high culture means that...
Does it mean opera? Does it mean ballet?
It means opera, ballet, literature, poems, whatever. What you, I guess, call high culture. We normally don't use the word Hochkultur, high culture. We just speak of culture, and by culture we mean exactly this.
And is that an element of the national character, or it's a more historical thing?
No, it's more a historical thing. In the book, I'm talking about an attitude, and I try to distinguish between a national character and an attitude. And I compare a national character to something which you cannot get rid of, and whereas I compare an attitude to the kind of your preferred garment, which you put on, but which you can also put off, and others actually can put it on as well.
Okay, this character of intense support and embrace of culture over and devaluing of politics, you say it's been catastrophic for Germany. Why is that?
Well, it has been catastrophic because it did not help, to put it mildly, to develop a view of politics which meant that really politics was something for the population at large, where everyone would have a stake in it. It meant regarding politics as something which would be carried out but by just a few over the many. It was an element of the kind of authoritarian character which has sometimes been ascribed to the Germans, perhaps a little bit, that was a little bit too much, but anyway. So we have on the one side a culture which does not only regard itself as superior to politics, but actually believes that it is the better politics, that if people would just listen to people who produce culture, they would be better off than if they would listen to those who are engaged in politics on a kind of professional basis.
And Wolf, were you talking about politics at large, or in fact specifically democratic politics?
I'm specifically talking about parliamentary politics in a democracy. I talk about politics which is the realm of compromise and not the realm of the absolute, as culture, high culture, has to be. High culture must strive for the absolute. It should not make compromises. But in politics, that's what you have to do every day.
Mm. Well, the starkest catastrophe, of course, was the rise of Nazism. How does this movement fit into your thesis?
Well, I think it played a role there, though one has to be careful and should not overestimate the influence of culture and cultural movements on the origin of Nazism. This had much more to do with a specific kind of German nationalism, with the kind of hidden or not so hidden racism in German thought, with unemployment, with Versailles, the results of the First World War, and so on and so forth. But there was a large part of the cultural intelligentsia in Germany which was attracted by what one has called the aesthetic elements in National Socialism, in fascism, which, after all, was a kind of mise-en-scene of politics, if you think of the party assemblance in Nuremberg and so on and so forth. And there were actually not just Germans attracted by it, but the French were as well, and even some Brits.
And when you say the aesthetic attraction, are we talking about those spectacular light shows? We're talking about,
yes,
Leni Riefenstahl. We're talking about that. We're talking about the
Leni Riefenstahl is perhaps the most visible element of it. But it is not just Leni Riefenstahl. There is the kind of aesthetic heroism in it. Again, a kind of attitude that some of the Nazi leaders displayed. And that was seen as, I said, an aesthetic element. And when actually some of the people who supported the Nazis then withdrew their support in 1934, it was more for aesthetic reasons than for moral or political reasons, because they thought this became a tasteless movement, as it were. But they were not so much interested in what was happening on the moral or on the political scale.
It was a crime against taste that they were performing.
Yes, I mean, when Hitler got rid of Röhm and the members of the SA, the SR, because he wanted to purify the movement and wanted to get rid of a competitor, I think everyone of those people I talk about, and there were quite some poets and writers among them, they would have accepted if there would have been a normal trial and these people would have been shot. But to murder them in the way the Hitler squadrons did, that was, as they said, tasteless, and they didn't like it. But that was an aesthetic argument. It was not a political one.
You're listening to Late Night Live on ABC Radio, National Radio Australia, and via the web and podcast. I'm speaking with Wolf Lepenies about his new book, The Seduction of Culture in German History. Just one of the points you make in the book that I found fascinating, because I had been taught erroneously, clearly at school, that Hitler was a house painter. I think it was maybe some an older history teacher's idea of, you know, how he could diminish Adolf Hitler. You make the point that Hitler and his circle were failed artists and intellectuals.
Well, there were quite some failed artists. I mean, Goebbels was another one who wanted to become a novelist and actually wrote a novel, which actually is not just dreadful. It is interesting. I mean, it's a bad novel, but it's not it's not the worst I know of. And Hitler really always said that what he really wanted to become, if possible, was a great painter. And I think it would be wrong to think that that was just a figure of speech. I think he meant it. He really believed in it. And when you read, when he talked at the dinner table, when he talked to Goebbels, more or less in private, there's always this one element that he says, my God, if the war would be over, then I could go back to art, and we would go to the movies, we would go to the theater, we would listen to Wagner, the music again, as we almost cannot do right now. I think he was serious about it. We don't want to believe that, but I think it was serious. And actually someone like Thomas Mann was so insightful because he believed in this.
In fact, there's a wonderful quotation where you've got Hitler talking to the British ambassador to Berlin. He's saying, I feel that I have it in my soul to become one of the great artists of the age.
Yes. That's, I think, you see, it's also, well, quite funny if one can speak.
Well, I'm afraid it is.
Use a word like funny in these in this context, that it was told that the only foreign politician Hitler would not have killed after the war, which, if he had won it, would have been Churchill, whom he despised, of course, but he accepted Churchill as a painter. So he said he would put him in jail, but he would give him all the means so that he could continue painting until the end of his life.
Very odd. Very odd,
yeah,
Wolf.
Very odd indeed, yes.
After the war, of course, after the division of the Germanies, did this for culture against politics, how did this play out?
Well, it still survived in, but then one has to distinguish between Western and Eastern Germany, between the German Democratic Republic and the Federal Republic. In the Federal Republic, after 1945, there is what Theodor Adorno, the German philosopher and sociologist, called the resurrection of culture. There is an incredible interest in high culture in the way we talked about it. And there is a kind of, again, this kind of apolitical feeling in the Germans, which actually they have to have because they don't believe that Germany will become a political subject again. But then this gradually disappears. And when West Germany becomes a member of the Western Alliance and NATO and the European Union, this disappears and is no longer really a problem. It comes back a little bit at the moment of reunification, but that's all. Whereas in East Germany, culture played really an enormous role, because the re-education of the Eastern Germans toward socialism should not least be achieved by a culture, by literary means. And Walter Ulbricht, the chairman of the communists, he always spoke about the GDR as Faust III, the third part of Faust, which Goethe never wrote. Also rather odd if one thinks of what was really happening there.
Mm. Look, obviously it's a very dense and fascinating book, but one thing I do particularly want to ask you, because the other European country, of course, which is famed for its attachment to culture, though not perhaps to the exclusion of politics, is France. Do you see any parallels between Germany's attachment to its culture, high culture, and France's?
No, I think there's a big difference. And the big difference is that in France, it is much easier to move from one sector of the elite to the other. So in France, you have people like André Malraux, who is, of course, an intellectual, who is a writer, but who becomes the Minister of Culture under de Gaulle, and actually a quite good minister. You have someone like François Mitterrand, who is president, but he thinks, and I think maybe not unrightly so, that he's also quite a good writer. You have today Monsieur de Villepin, who thinks that he is a very good historian. I think he maybe is a decent historian. I don't know whether he's a very good historian. So in France, these things mingle, whereas in Germany, they do not mingle. So you stay aloof from politics, but you believe that you are the better politician. In France, you become a politician, and you think you are a better politician because you have this basis in culture. But that's a big difference.
You know, I would love to talk to you further. I would like to ask you about Angela Merkel and whether she, in fact, has a lower soul for being a politician, but we'll have to wait for another time. Thank you so much for joining us, though, tonight. Fascinating.
Thank you.
That's very interesting, isn't it? Wolf Lepenies, author of The Seduction of Culture in German History. Well, on our next LNL, we'll be talking to medical ethicist Jonathan Marino about the US government's expanding interest in neuroscience as a weapon of war. And we'll also be looking at the unseemly argument that's taking place in paleontological circles about the Indonesian hobbit. Now, you'll be aware of the controversy that's been raging for some time about the hobbit. When it was discovered, there was tremendous excitement. We were told, in fact, it was a whole new species found in the island of Flores, very close, new neighbours. But in fact, as further investigation has continued, dating has gone on, an unholy row has broken out around these bones. There's something about archaeology. Remember the fuss over Lucy? It just seems to bring out the worst in us. But that's it from me tonight. Stay around on the ABC Radio National now for the news, and I will look forward to speaking to you again tomorrow night. See you then.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.